you're going to take resources away from the system, you have to give resources back. And so I just basically outlined three principles of financing from the federal government. I said it should be consistent, meaningful, and equitable.
Well, welcome back to the Public Money Pod, a production of the Center for Municipal Finance at the University of Chicago's Harris School of Public Policy, where we are proudly sponsored, of course, by the Government Finance Officers Association, Odyssey Advisors, Build America Mutual, and Muni Pro. I'm Justin Marlowe, joined as always by my intrepid co-host, Marylander, bona fide fiscal policy expert, lover of all things springtime, Liz Farmer. Liz, welcome back.
Yes, indeed. Thanks, Justin. And spring has finally sprung up here on the mountain. So really happy about that. I've kicked the planting season into high gear now. I had some indoor starters. And I'm like a little kid with this stuff. I like run over every day to see if anything else has sprouted. So I'm an impatient planter. but yeah, very excited.
It seems like the last few years especially it's really been a gamble. Like you get a stretch and you think, okay, it's time, we can take it all outside, and then you get snow or you get a cold snow or whatever.
Yes. Yeah, we had snow actually a week ago, and so this would have been like the first week of April we had snow, which is, yeah, that's still unusual around here.
Not conducive not Chicago. To gardening. Yeah, well, yeah, it, that's right. Yeah, we're kind of used to it here, but nonetheless, it teases the idea of being able to get the garden kicked off and do all those outdoor summery kinds of things sooner than later. But good problems to have, I suppose, this time of year.
True.
So we're talking today about elections administration, and we're fortunate to have on the pod Professor Zach Moore from the University of Kansas, who's done a lot of really interesting work around the cost of running elections. Certainly when we think about elections, we often think about the cost of campaigns, that is, how much candidates are going to spend in the course of running for office. The 2020 presidential election was the most expensive ever. I think it was somewhere in the neighborhood of $15 billion was spent. And even locally, we had just here in Cook County in the most recent election cycle a few weeks ago, we had an election for the state's attorney that I think something in the neighborhood of $70 million was spent on. So it seems like campaigns become more and more expensive. It's more difficult to get a ground game up and running, lots of social media, lots of other kind of advertising. As a public money person, you look at this and you think, well, that's actually not an unwise investment. $14 billion is about what Medicare spends maybe in a week. And so if you are trying to influence health policy to your advantage, that's a pretty small investment actually to make in a way that might be really advantageous. And you can think of similar kinds of efforts to influence policy in lots of other areas. But nonetheless, that's a lot of money. And a lot of people like to clue into just how much is spent on campaigns. Nonetheless, this being the Public Money Pod, we think the overlooked part of that is what it costs to actually deliver the service called running an election. What does it mean to administer an election? What are those costs? How do those costs vary from place to place? And we're fortunate to have Zach to explain all of that to us. This is, of course, a really, really hot issue as of late, going into the 2024 election and all the concerns just about how contentious the election is likely to be, but also concerns about election security, cyber attacks, interference, all these things which ultimately become local issues when you think about who's going to have to protect that election infrastructure against that sort of interference. So a really important discussion to have here today. Liz, certainly you've followed this and many, many related issues in your work on state and local public finance. What comes to mind when you think about elections administration and its broader implications?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of things. And one is just, I think the public's general perception of who, like what government they kind of think of when they think of elections. And in my opinion, that is typically people think about elections, they think about the federal government elections. And that bears out in the fact that every 4 years when it's a presidential election, we get a lot higher voter turnout than in any other year. In years where it's just local officials on the ballot. I remember one year in when I was still living in Rockville, it was, I think it was just like a county council race and that was it. That year. And I think voter turnout was 2% or something. I mean, it was super low, super, super low. And that's probably not unusual for a ballot like that. But I guess what that means is, but it's not the federal government that pays the most. It's much like education. You know, the federal government pays a little bit, state governments pay a lot, pay more, way more, and then local governments bear most of the cost. And elections are structured very similarly, but even a little bit more tenuous because the federal government is allocating or making grant funding available. It's not as much of a guaranteed even small amount as it is with these other major state costs, state and local costs. So that's one thing I think about is that it really is state and local governments and mostly local governments that are bearing the cost, despite the fact that the general perception from the public, we tend to think about the national elections. So that's one thing. And then the other thing that kind of strikes me about this is that it, you mentioned technology and how much just even over the course of my, in the last couple of decades, how things have changed with the option for voters. I remember when early voting first started, you know, rolling out. And then, I mean, for the longest time, it was just you had to go, you had, if you couldn't be there in person, you had to request an absentee ballot and you had to have a good reason for why you were doing so. And that was it. The rest of us had to show up on voting day and wait in a big long line if it was a presidential election year. But things have changed a lot since then. And that's something in terms of election administration and cost that kind of adds all these different levers to I guess the whole picture for state and locals. So there's the cost of mail-in ballots, but then less cost on election day and kind of all these different things now that state and local governments can weigh when it comes to managing the cost of elections and more options now than they really used to, which is, I suppose, great on one hand, but then also makes things super complicated on the other. And then there's cybersecurity as well. So there's, I think there's just a lot more in the mix now than there was a couple of decades ago.
Yeah, 100%. And to the point then about the cyclicality of it, it really does beg that question of what is election infrastructure? I mean, I think you're right. It used to be that it was some machines, some training for some people. These days, you need a much larger kind of permanent infrastructure to have the ability to print those ballots and mail them, to have the ability to do ongoing monitoring of cybersecurity concerns, all of this. It really does require an ongoing set of investments and not just that big surge of spending that you get around the big high profile elections, particularly the national elections. And that changes how you think about paying for it. It changes and in many ways puts elections administration in direct competition then with other kinds of services. At the county level, especially, you're now having to compete with funding for rural roads or funding for public health or funding for other kinds of core services that counties administer. And as important as elections are, they're just, in some cases, not as sexy as some of the other things that counties do. So it really does create some real challenges. And so we're really pleased to have Zach on to be able to unpack those challenges for us. Well, we're pleased to welcome to the Public Money Pod, Professor Zach Moore from the University of Kansas. Professor Moore, Rock Chalk, welcome to the Public Money Pod.
Hello, Professor Marlowe, Rock Chalk.
I must have missed that one. welcome to the pod. And I can see you're decked out with your Kansas, is that a Kansas GFOA sweater? Sweatshirt, very nice. Looking the part. I think one thing that I think would be helpful to start off with is just let's talk about election administration in a nutshell. Who pays for it? What are some of the big costs that go into running an election?
Yeah. So the elections administration is kind of this simple topic. It seemingly sounds simple, I suppose, but it's increasingly complex in terms of the different sorts of technology and equipment that's needed to record votes, different sorts of electronic poll books and the like. And so when it comes to elections administration, we have both the costs of conducting the election. So these are the things like printing ballots, training poll workers that are going to be just during the election time period, different sorts of contracts for the polling places. Those are the costs of the election. The cost of elections administration is the broader set of costs that a city or county has to incur throughout the year. And so You have to maintain elections equipment. You have to have different sorts of contracts to make sure that if there's problems with it on elections day or different sorts of security patches that need to be applied, all of those things and just the general cost of having people in the elections office or the clerk's office to answer comments and or answer questions and, you know, audit results and respond to whatever sort of reporting requirements that they have. Those are costs throughout the entire year. When we think about elections administration and the costs of elections, we really divide it between the two cost objects, the cost objects of the election itself, and then the broader cost of all of elections administration throughout the year.
I'm not so sure. Yeah, that's I'm glad you differentiated between that, because I think most people just think of what happens on election day. You know, it's what most of what we see, but there's stuff going on all the time.
Yes, exactly. There's all sorts of administrative things that are happening in the background that none of us would ever see unless you went into an elections office or took a tour and had people explain it to you. So a big part of why I and a lot of others do these sorts of talks is, one, to make people more aware of the topic, but also just to make people feel better about how much thought and security really goes into elections administration, because it's a really important process, and we want people to be assured that it works and that the results are fair.
How often is this performed at, say, the county level versus some other unit of government?
Yeah, so that's a great question. Counties are the primary units of government that conduct elections in most states, right? So there's about 3,000 counties in the United States. There's also, in two states, Wisconsin and Michigan, each one of them have over 1,000 units of government that also conduct elections. And so there's a little over 3,000 election jurisdictions that are counties, over 3,000 jurisdictions in just those two states. There's two states, Alaska and Delaware, that conduct elections at the state level. And then the rest is pretty much a mix of cities, towns, villages, townships, and counties. There's over 8,000 local election jurisdictions in the United States. So elections administration is a pretty amazing thing that it actually happens with all the different moving parts at the local, state, and federal level.
And I'm sure the answer is it varies, but in general, when we talk about who's paying for this, you know, what's the mix of local dollars versus state dollars versus other types of funding sources?
I would say that primarily it's funded at the local level. What's interesting in we'll probably get into this more, is that we don't have a perfect answer to how much it costs to do elections administration. So I can't give you an exact percentage. What I can do is tell you a little bit about the history of elections administration, because the history is kind of interesting. And it's something that, you know, I think you both and probably a lot of listeners will remember. I won't go all the way back to the 5th century BC and talk about the very first elections. That would be overkill. I won't even go back to early elections in the colonies and the country. But the really interesting thing that happened in terms of financing elections administration happened after the 2000 election. Hmm. And so if you'll remember, Bush versus Gore happened, and there was a little problem down in Florida. You know, I say hanging, you say chads, right? We all remember hanging chads, especially my friend Chad, that said that it was the worst year of his life. But, you know, it basically caused a constitutional crisis, and the balance of the election was hanging on the fact that we had this one election down in Florida that was super close, and it was, everybody could see that it was the election technology, the votes, it was hard to count, which which votes were going for whom. So sometimes you might have hanging chads for both candidates. And so did they vote for both or neither? Who knew? So the elections equipment had to be changed. At that point, there was no doubt that local jurisdictions needed help. And so for the first time in American history, the federal government paid for elections administration materials. So the Help America Vote Act, right after the 2000 election, gave $3.2 billion to state and local governments to distribute down to the election jurisdictions and to buy new equipment. For about 15 years after the first HABA, the federal government just said, we're going to go back to our usual way of doing things where it's going to be up to the state and local governments to finance this. But at about the 2016 election changed things again for the state versus local mix. In the 2016 election, there was Russian interference. And in one case, I believe it was Illinois, there might have been some Russian hacking of some poll books. And so the federal government did a big study on this, and in 2018 denoted elections administration as critical infrastructure so that it could get Department of Homeland Security funding and assistance to help with cybersecurity issues. They also gave, I want to say, $300 million. I don't remember off the top of my head exactly how much they gave in 2018, but it was quite a bit to address issues of cybersecurity. And then, of course, in 2020, we had the pandemic, which caused lots of problems for elections worldwide. There was a lot of elections going on throughout the world. The United States did, the federal government did in 2000. I think they gave like 400-ish million, but that was nowhere near probably what was needed. The federal government, again, in 2022, and most recently in 2024, a few weeks ago when they passed the omnibus appropriations bill, they again funded elections administration in those 2 years. So we had the original financing of elections by the federal government and right after the 2000 election with HABA, and then you have the 2018, 2020, 22, and now 24. So hopefully there's a pattern there, a precedent that the federal government should be paying for some of those costs, particularly the ones that concern the entire country. So things like cybersecurity and other security measures. Those would be the ones that I think the federal government should pay for.
So we've talked a lot about the federal money. I know you've done some work looking at the state and local contribution to this. And I think, if I remember right, one of the big findings from your work is that there's a lot of variation across states and sometimes even within states on how much state and local money goes into elections. What accounts for that variation, and does it matter?
There is a lot of variation, both between the states and within the states, and it definitely does matter. You know, so if you were to plot out on a map where most of the spending is, of course, most of the spending is in the largest jurisdictions, so LA, Chicago, New York. But we typically look at it in terms of spending per registered voter or spending per ballot cast. Usually I like to look at spending per registered voter just because it's a little more consistent over time. But if you look at it within a state, let's take North Carolina, for example, what you'd see in terms of spending per registered voter would be that the highest costs are actually in the mountains to the west and on the coastal areas to the east. Basically, the most rural parts of the state have the highest cost per voter. And the reason for that is one of the most consistent findings with all of the research on elections administration costs is economies of scale. So larger jurisdictions can drive down the costs of elections administration. They probably have more resources to begin with, but it's just easier to conduct an election in a city than it is in a rural mountainous county in North Carolina. So that's the biggest thing, but there's other production factors and demand factors that influence the cost of elections. So one of the big ones is mode of voting. So we know that in states in the West, particularly, they've switched more towards mail voting. And not surprisingly, perhaps, the amount of spending per registered voter in those Western states is going down. So we know from other research that mail voting is cheaper than traditional in-person voting. You know, there's additional variable costs because you have the postage and things, but that's offset by needing fewer election workers on elections day. So the mode of voting matters. If they changed mode of voting in the past year or two, that causes the amount of spending to increase as you switch over. So it's almost like this production process. Like there's this really kind of manufacturing-esque element to elections administration. But the other thing about it is that there's the demand side variables. And the demand side, we know that things like education of the community increase what is desired to be spent on elections administration. And there's a political element to it as well. There's definitely political incentives for politicians to think strategically about maybe increasing the amount that's spent to increase turnout or vice versa if they don't want turnout. One of the things that we've looked at in our research is the trade-offs that local elections officials have to make or elected officials have to make. And, you know, elections are this weird kind of service that mostly counties, but also these other jurisdictions have to provide. And unlike some services where you can see the immediate impact of another dollar for that service, like if you spend more for teachers, you see that, you know, there's more teachers in the classroom every year, or maybe you see more police officers on your street, or in the more extreme case, the very long run, public welfare, or, you know, some sorts of long range planning or pensions or whatever. Those are very long run. Elections are this weird thing that's kind of in between, where you see the results of the funding like in 2 or 4 years. And so you don't have the immediacy of we need it right now. What often happens, our elections officials tell us, are things like, you know, we need the elections equipment, but the you know, public works department needs to fill potholes right now. So we're going to fill the potholes. We're not going to, you know, invest in elections equipment. Elections are kind of this really interesting intermediate temporally good. And so we've kind of looked at the temporal and the partisan dimensions of that. And it does. It's a little bit better funded than public welfare, but not as well funded, perhaps, as public safety and public education. So
Zach, you testified to Congress recently on these and some other issues, and congratulations for that. Incidentally, had many of us tuning into C-SPAN in the middle of the day to check it out. Give us the just 30-second summary of what the key takeaways were from your testimony, and what sort of broader debate were you trying to inform with that testimony?
The purpose of that testimony was about, should we allow the private financing of elections administration? To me, the part that I was hoping to underline was that if you're going to take away those resources for the elections jurisdictions that are in a lot of cases financially strapped and not able to have all the resources that they might want or need for elections, where is it going to come from? And it really needs to come from the federal government. So my main point was to underline that if you're going to take resources away from the system, you have to give resources back. And so I just basically outlined three principles of financing from the federal government. I said it should be consistent, meaningful, and equitable. And the last part is, I think, often overlooked in elections administration financing, because they tend to take the approach of, well, you know, we're all making hamburgers. It's like McDonald's, and, you know, the cost of making hamburgers should be the same everywhere. Well, it's not really like a McDonald's. One state might be, you know, a gourmet hamburger, and the other state may be the barest, flimsiest little hamburger you've ever eaten. So the costs are not the same. And, you know, we have these costs like the rural jurisdictions that have natural needs for more money for conducting elections and less populous places. So to hand out equal amounts of money on a per voter basis, or just even worse, like they did this last time, basically $1 million to each state, that's inherently inequitable.
Just on the cost factor, and that not all states are the same. I mean, having voted a few times absentee in California, I mean, California leaves a lot of ballot questions for the citizen, for residents to answer. And, you know, you get your absentee ballot along with like an entire book's worth of information that I don't know who spends the time going through all of it. I think a lot of us try, but I mean, I can't imagine what it costs to print that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, and, you know, you talk about California, and I was just talking to somebody out in LA last week. And, you know, you gotta remember that you have to print all of these ballots in multiple languages. Mm-hmm. I think they said 23 different languages. So every ballot, every precinct's a little different. And so all the, you know, hundreds or maybe thousands of different ways in LA that ballots that you have to have, and then you have to have them in 23 different languages. The complexity of it is just really, really amazing. Yeah.
What are Zuckerbucks? Maybe you could define that for our audience. And then we saw that Wisconsin just passed a ban on them. So if you could talk about that too, I'd love to hear it.
Yeah, no. Zuckerbucks comes from a Wall Street Journal article about the private financing of elections. And it was one of the first pieces on private financing after the 2020 election. Since Zuckerberg had given the money, they came up with this funny name of Zuckerbucks, and Zuckerbucks kind of stuck. So now the private financing of elections administration is banned in 27 think Wisconsin might have been the 27th or the 28th state. I can't remember. So the majority of states now are banning the private financing of elections administration. But this is kind of sad. And on the one hand, you can see the concern for potentially abusing the system if very wealthy people can give hundreds of millions of dollars for elections administration. You could conceivably increase turnout in particular areas. First of all, the way that they were done was just anyone that applied got money. So it was really kind of amazing to most of the election administrators that applied how much money they got. They were expecting maybe a few thousand dollars, and in some cases they got hundreds of thousands of dollars. Because the jurisdictions that have the largest capacity to apply for grants are often larger areas, and larger areas tend to be Democratic leaning. The majority of the grants went towards Democratic jurisdictions. It wasn't intended, I don't think, with the purpose of being openly partisan, but it definitely, after the fact, appeared as if there was that there could be partisan elements to this. I think what's sad to me is that there were a lot of other people and organizations that also gave during the pandemic to election jurisdictions. Most notably, Arnold Schwarzenegger gave a couple million dollars to election jurisdictions in California and in the West, I believe. But other companies love to donate towards elections administration because, you know, it's as American as apple pie. So it's good business to make donations to these things. And especially during the pandemic, I think Budweiser gave out lots and lots of hand sanitizer that it had made beer into alcohol, hand sanitizing alcohol, and sent it out to just about every election jurisdiction in the country. I think, you know, the Carolina Panthers, you know, opened their stadium so that people could come in and do it in open air. All of these things would be banned now. And the nonprofits that have historically worked with election jurisdictions to help them with like really complex things like ballot design so that you get all the state regulations and that they're accessible easy to read and follow. All of those things are going to be banned now. And so that's problematic. You have this one event that looked in the end as if it could be partisan, and then the end result is that you end up banning all private financing, and that's a bit problematic as far as I'm concerned. And that's why I think if we're not going to allow private financing of elections, then we really need to encourage the federal government to step in and help states and local governments that are struggling.
We're months away from kind of a big election. It's probably going to be the most closely watched in history, maybe other than the election of 1800. Little fun history put down there. Anyway, what do you recommend for election officials, particularly those on the local level? What do you recommend they do between now and the election period, we'll say, to be prepared as much as one could be?
I think that the elections officials actually are very prepared. And like I said at the beginning of the podcast, a big reason that I and others come on these types of shows and talk about elections is to give people the information so that hopefully you can see that elections administration in the United States is kind of a miraculous thing that it happens. And that in terms of the costs and financing of elections administration, what is different this time around as opposed to 2020 is that a lot of jurisdictions are in much better financial shape than they were in the 2020 election. You know, in a lot of states, you know, the fiscal year starts in the 1st of July. And so the 2020 election was the calendar year or fiscal year 2021. And so they were making cuts to elections administration budgets in 2020. The difference now is that a lot of jurisdictions they might not be flush with cash, but you know, we've had ARPA dollars and we've had some other federal dollars, and sales tax has been pretty good. Local sources have been stable. So I think that in terms of financing, we are in a pretty good spot at the local level. Like I said, you know, states and federal governments probably have a better role to step up, but I'm not nearly as worried about the financing this time around as I was in 2020.
Well, thanks so much, Professor Zach Moore from the University of Kansas. We really appreciate you giving us some time today on the Public Money Pod.
Thank you. I appreciated getting to come and talk about it.
Thanks again to Zach for coming on the show and talking with us about elections, all things election administration, really giving us some good insights there into what local governments in particular face when it comes to running these things. And I think giving us a lot of food for thought too, especially later this year. The story I pulled, I wanted to look at that federal funding aspect a little bit more that Zach mentioned. And there was a story that came out fairly recently on VoteBeat, which is a nonprofit news organization that probably, as you can tell from the title, focuses a lot on elections and voting. So this one's by Carrie Levine, and the headline is "Critical Federal Election Administration Grant Funding Struggles through Congress. This story picks up on the fact that there have been government shutdowns or government shutdown threats much more these days. And every few months we seem to be talking about it. And so this one noted, now I haven't kept track of the latest, but I don't think there's one coming. I think we're okay for a while now. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting that, you know, as a reporter, when I've thought about shutdown threats, I mean, if I go to like things, the social safety net stuff. But coming up on an election year, a shutdown threat can also threaten some of this federal funding or even grant funding that can be made available to states. So this story kind of goes into that and explains a little bit, gives some good background too on just that federal role as well. And so the story notes that most money for administering elections does come from state and local governments, and the work is becoming more complex. Not all local governments are able to keep up with this growing cost burden. She notes that that federal government has declared elections to be critical infrastructure, but the amount it allocates to states and localities is pretty sporadic. So in 2018, an election year, the figure was $380 million. In the 2020 election year, there was $425 million allocated, and then there was an additional $400 million as part of COVID relief funding. But last year, which was not a major election year, major federal election year, it was just $75. Oh gosh, why bother? $75 million. and this year there are election security grants made available, as Zach mentioned, through the Department of Homeland Security. But it's a very up and down thing. The bill also mentions $55 million allocated as well, and so it's unpredictable, and nobody likes things being unpredictable, and particularly when you come up on the fact that shutdown threats create this unpredictability for federal funding and grant funding and when it's going to flow and what will the ultimate amount be. Adding that layer on a funding situation that is already seems to be innately unpredictable really kind of puts a lot in what I'm getting out of the story is that it does put a lot on the shoulders of state and local governments, and they're already carrying most of the burden. The story interviews Rachel Ori, who's with the Elections Project at the Bipartisan Policy Center, and she notes that election officials need time to plan investments thoroughly. This is a quote from her. And the erratic nature of federal funding has routinely limited that effectiveness. And she says that once they do receive this funding, which it is going through, that election officials are likely to spend it on things like increasing poll worker pay and hiring more temporary workers, combating bad information. That's, I'm sure, a relatively recent spend line item, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And updating security. So there's just some good kind of basic background information here that I wanted to highlight, but it really kind of brings up to the top that notion of unpredictability in something that is already difficult for state and local governments. So thought it was interesting to share. Justin, what were some of the takeaways that you had from this?
Yeah, it really does a nice job of laying this out in a lot of really clear detail. I'll admit that in our conversation with Zach, I was a little bit surprised at the way he described it as this sort of ebb and flow over time in the federal government's role. And the idea that we kind of think of the federal government having a big role in local election administration is a relatively new thing, or at least we're back at the point in the cycle where the federal government is more involved. And it seems like every other time that the federal government has been less involved, or there's been a deliberate choice to have the federal government be less involved, it's for reasons that have more to do with how it is that states and localities feel like they're best positioned to administer elections. Sure seems like from this article that we might be headed in the direction of states and localities saying, we're going to have to take this on ourselves because we can't count on the federal government anymore. And I could see that happening. That's going to get at that question then of places that are more able to afford to put hundreds of millions of dollars into effective elections administration. And then that gets into questions of when and where there's less investment happening and what implications that might have for who's voting and ultimately what happens in elections. So it's this really tricky catch-22 situation. The federal government money certainly helps even things out and creates a more, we might call, sort of horizontal equity across the entire system, making sure that there's a baseline level of resources available from one place to the next. And yet, as you're saying, you have to plan for these things months and months and months in advance. And being at the at the whim of the politics of federal budgeting. It's just not a good place to be if you're trying to administer state and local elections. So it's this really interesting catch-22. But my takeaway from this is, if you had to prognosticate a little bit, you could see a situation where states and maybe large counties and other big players in the local space kind of say, the federal help is great if we can get it, but we're not going to count on it. And so let's start now appropriating the dollars in the state budget and in local budgets and make sure that we have that predictability and do the best that we can with the resources that we have. Thanks again to our season two sponsors, Build America Mutual, MuniPro, Odyssey Advisors, and the Government Finance Officers Association. The Public Money Pod is a production of the Center for Municipal Finance at the University of Chicago's Harris School of Public Policy, where we are proudly produced by Hannah Burnick. You can learn more about the center and its work at munifinance.uchicago.edu. That's munifinance.uchicago.edu. You can learn more about Liz Farmer's work at her Substack, Long Story Short. That's Long Story Short. Thanks again for listening. We'll catch you next time on the Public Money Pod.